That Wellbeing at Work show is brought to you by Body Boost, the wellbeing engagement platform that employees actually use. Find out more at bodyboost.co.uk.
Welcome to That Wellbeing at Work show. Earlier in the year, we released a season of episodes that explored in depth the world of workplace wellbeing. We talked to some of the world's preeminent thinkers to bring you a range of views and opinions. We set out to test much of the accepted orthodoxy about workplace wellbeing so that we could help you define what wellbeing means to you and your organisation. This compilation episode brings together the key messages from our wellbeing journey. I start with award-winning psychologist and best-selling author Gethin Naden, who is widely considered as one of the world's leading employee well-being influencers, and I ask him to define what well-being is. So, employee well-being, we hear the term all of the time, and I wondered if you had a sort of a clear definition of what we're talking about. I mean, some people say there are four pillars, others five, and actually on Google this morning I found someone who's saying there are even six pillars of well-being. What is it all about?
I think lots of organisations are still struggling to define what well-being means to them. I work with customers who have five pillars of well-being. I've got one customer who's got 26 pillars of
well-being. Do they know what the 26 are?
it's basically they've just drilled down into more detail. But okay. For me, it's broad. There's broadly kind of five areas. Some of those will be familiar to your listeners: physical well-being, financial well-being. I like to use emotional well-being rather than mental health. I like us to focus on the idea that we all have this kind of sliding scale of mental health, and some days we feel a bit rubbish and some days we feel great. And actually, you know, it's not just about the absence of a mental health condition that can kind of affect our mood. So emotional well-being is one of the ones for me. Another one I like to use is community well-being. So for me at work, that includes the relationships we have with the people that we work with, the sense of community and belonging we kind of feel at work, but also outside of work. So how we practice in altruism, how we kind of volunteer in and donate to charity and creating a better society. And that then starts to seep into some of the environmental, social and governance issues as well. So how are we creating better societies? Because there's very close links between well-being and sustainability. And then lastly, leisure well-being. I think, you know, I came up with that term before the pandemic, but I think as soon as the pandemic hit, we all started to realize how important it actually was to spend time on the things we love doing with the people that we love and having those opportunities to kind of decompress and de-stress from work. Spending time with people is really, really important. So whether that's spiritual, cultural pursuits, just going to the cinema or going to a bar, whatever it is that people do to kind of make life fulfilling, I think that's a really important part of well-being. And I think if you think about it in those kind of broad five pillars, you start to really move away from the idea that well-being can be solved by just buying stuff, which is what I think a lot of the market is focused on at the moment.
I go on to ask Gethin about why organisations should be bothered about well-being and how, as a newly appointed HR director, how would I begin to build a well-being strategy?
Why should an organisation then be bothered about it?
I think we now have enough vast and compelling evidence that those organizations that commit to employee well-being perform better. But it kind of makes sense, right? If you think about, you know, we are a long, long way away from the idea that people go to work to get a pay and that's it. When we support them, when we take care of them, when we enable them to thrive, they produce better things for us. They design better products. They deliver better customer service. They sell more products. And so it's really about an investment in people. And I think that's the view most people now have about well-being. If you don't understand the impact that employee well-being has on your organization, then I don't know what to tell you. I think if you don't get that already, then you might as well switch off this podcast now, because we're not going to convince you anymore.
Look, I'm a newly appointed HR director or chief people officer, and I'm building an employee well-being strategy from scratch. And I sort of want to know, what foundations do you think I ought to have in place even before I start looking at any technology or well-being vendors to help support my objective? What would you say the very first thing that you would do?
I think you start to get to the point, which is, why are we doing well-being? Why is well-being important to this organization? Because, you know, when I first got into this industry, well-being was about, how do I get you back at work and productive as soon as possible? If you break your leg, how do I get you back? I'll give you private medical because I want you to get treatment straight away because I want you back at work. That's now changed to, well, no, I care about you and I want to do right by you. And I know that unless you're in the right frame of mind and in a good, happy, healthy place, I'm not going to get the best out of you. So how do I fix those things to make sure that you kind of are as productive and as engaged as I need you to be? And so I would say the first thing to do is kind of consider, why is well-being important to this organization? Why are we doing it? And what do we hope to get out of it? And then how do we make sure we design that around what the employee wants and needs? Because everything else will start to fall into place following that.
Finally, I put it together that if we don't tackle the root causes of what makes people unhappy at work, such as toxic work cultures, then all the well-being efforts will simply fail.
And if you're looking at well-being in general in terms of the organisation, then I was just thinking, you know, if stress and anxiety and burnout, these are words that are, you know, that are used all the time, and it seems to be endemic in most workplaces. And shouldn't leaders, therefore, and in particular HR directors or leaders, be sort of directly addressing the causes of some of this stress at work? And if we don't tackle things like poor job design and toxic work cultures and presenteeism and unrealistic deadlines and all of that, is all of the well-being in the world at work rather useless if we don't actually look at the fundamentals of the work and the workplace?
I wouldn't say it was useless, but I think the boom of these kind of well-being apps and well-being solutions that employers can go and buy has muddied the water around that kind of definition of well-being. And if you think about those five pillars I spoke about at the start, you know, within that stuff, it's like, you know, if I've got a friend at work, I'm more likely to be engaged. I'm more likely to stay loyal to that business. I'm less likely to kind of feel lonely outside of work. And so again, that's sort of our well-being is kind of the connections we have in the workplace. And it's where you start to see the crossover between well-being and diversity and inclusion, for example. Somebody who doesn't feel welcome in your organization is more likely to develop a mental health condition. Mm. If you are a black employee, if you are a woman, if you are a gay employee, you're all more likely to develop poor mental health because of the way society is structured against you. And so the workplace needs to change, not just because diversity and inclusion is something we should all be doing and actually commits quite strongly to organizational success. It's part of well-being as well.
Gethin mentioned the link between DE&I and well-being. So in order to understand the relationship better, I asked Sandy Wasmer, the Chief Executive of the Employers Network for Equality and Inclusion, to explain. What's the link then between diversity, equality, inclusion and well-being?
There is an absolute link. You know, if you're thinking in the way that we're thinking about people being able to bring their whole selves to work and being psychologically safe and feeling that sense of belonging, whoever they are, wherever they come from, whatever their protected characteristic is, or whether they have characteristics that fall outside of protected characteristics like social inclusion or gender identity. So there's other things that fall outside of the Equality Act. So it's making sure that people feel psychologically safe at work, and well-being is key. The link to well-being and belonging is really important to understand, because when people feel connected to other human beings and they feel a sense of belonging, that's a key component of emotional well-being. And so obviously well-being is far greater than emotional. You have emotional well-being, psychological well-being, financial well-being, spiritual well-being. So there's lots of different types of well-being. But when you're thinking about people's well-being at work, having them feel safe, having that feel that sense of belonging, and allowing them to be ultimately as happy as they can at work, because happy people are more productive, and that's just better for business. So the link between well-being and equality, diversity, and inclusion is essential.
We hear about feeling safe at work a great deal these days, so I asked Sandy to define this, and how can organizations create a culture that is psychologically safe?
Okay. And when we sort of say making somebody feel safe at work, what do we mean by that?
Psychological safety. So it's making them feel they can be exactly who they are, that they're not afraid, they're not in fear of being discriminated against, that they can be open. And open is also, a bit of a continuum, so as open as they're comfortable being, but not feeling afraid to be just who they are, to be able to be yourself.
And what can organizations do then to foster that sense of psychological safety?
It's about culture. It's about leadership. It's about, it needs to come from the top. And it really is about culture. You can put lots of policies in place, and you can have lots of initiatives and programs, which is the same actually for ED&I. You can have lots of programs in place, but unless the culture is right and it comes from the top and the leaders are ultimately saying this matters to us, and you know, and we want to make sure that all employees feel that sense of belonging. Because, for example, if you say to people, well, we don't expect you to work crazy hours, we want you to have a flexible work environment, and yet the leaders are all working 100-hour weeks and expecting other people to, well, that's, you know, there's a policy in place, but the practice isn't the same. And so it's about making sure that the culture is a culture where people are able to be the most productive. And a lot of the things that you know, we've seen over the past couple of years, you know, we now know that we can work hybrid or flexible, and that people don't need to be chained to their desks. So, you know, it's all about productivity over presenteeism. And it's about making sure that that human being, which is ultimately coming to work, if they're not an employee, you're a human being. And that human being that's coming to work is being who they are and able to feel comfortable and able to have the complexities of their human life in the workplace and feel that they're not going to be discriminated against, or they're not going to be not supported. And so, you know, it's yes, of course, you need the right policies in place and compliance with the Equality Act. All of those things matter. But what really matters probably more than anything is culture.
Stephen Bevan is the head of HR Research Development at the Institute for Employment Studies. I asked Stephen to explain the difference between employee benefits and well-being.
I think that employers have been struggling for years to try and work out what it is they can do to go beyond their health and safety duties. And some of them have chosen the path of providing benefits for their employees. So they will offer them, you know, fruit bowls and, the option to eat lettuce in the canteen and subsidized gym membership and fun runs and pedometer challenges and so on. And, you know, on their own, there's no harm in doing that at all. I mean, the danger, of course, is that it's only people who are already looking after their health or, you know, being very active in terms of trying to make behavioural change, like stopping smoking or losing weight and so on, who will take part in those sorts of things. And actually, for the most part, there's almost no evidence at all they make very much difference to people's health, but they do give people a sense of belonging and a sense that their employer is taking care of them and is concerned about their well-being. And I suppose that the real test is, if an employer does those things, what are they measuring? Are they measuring whether people are healthier, or they take less sickness absence, or their recovery time from illness or injury is quicker? No, they don't. Almost exclusively, they don't. They measure how many people eat the lettuce or eat the fruit or go to the gym. So they measure take-up rather than the long-term benefits. Now, there are other organisations, and unfortunately there are far fewer of them, who are genuinely interested in trying to promote positive health outcomes for their employees. They're trying to avoid people in situations where their work is so intense that no matter how individually resilient people are, they're always going to succumb to work pressure or work intensity. And so rather than dealing with the symptoms of the problem, which sometimes the benefits approach does, some organisations are trying to go back to the real root causes and say it's actually the way people are managed, it's the jobs that they do, the way that work is organised, that actually is going to have the most sustained impact on people's well-being at work. That's far more difficult to do, but most of the evidence is it's far more effective if you really care about health.
I then asked Stephen to help me understand what well-being fundamentals need to be in place before organisations start providing benefits.
What would you, if you could start from scratch, what would you tell an organisation to do?
If I were going just from what the evidence says, then I wouldn't be going down the route of having lots of fancy eye-catching gizmos or interventions that make me look good but really don't make much impact. And the uncomfortable truth is that most of the things that make a difference are systemic. They're to do with the way the organisation is managed, its culture, the quality of life management, the amount of control and autonomy people have in their jobs. And most crucially, the balance between the demands on people in their jobs and the resources they have available to them. And that's usually psychological resources. So I think it's about designing jobs well, training managers to be aware of the contribution they make to people's well-being and flourishing at work and so on. And that all sounds very woolly, because it's much easier for me to say, well, you should definitely have more fruit in the canteen and so on, or you should make sure that people are doing regular exercise. It's not as simple as that, unfortunately. And I think that it comes down to partly a state of mind, partly about leadership recognizing that they have to go beyond their legal duty of care to keep people safe, not just about people going home safely every day. And it's creating a work environment where people feel able to give best of themselves, and also that they know that they're going to be able to be fulfilled in what they do. And I think I see a direct sort of golden triangle between well-being, performance, and things like retention and commitment and so on of people to the organization. And they're massively powerful things in combination. And I think that's definitely worth bearing in mind. So I will be making sure that all the things you're trying to do to maximize performance and retention and attraction and commitment are working, because they also affect people's well-being at work.
In a series of clips, I asked Janet Layton, Timpson's Director of Happiness, about what initiatives Timpson have in place for the cost of living crisis, what new well-being initiatives the firm is working on, and a little more about the firm's very public focus on positive mental health provision. Now, you're the Director of Happiness, which I always think is the nicest business title I've ever come across. Can you tell me what you do?
My role really is to look after all our superstars, whether that's their well-being, emotional well-being, or whether that's their financial well-being, and do anything we can as a business to look after them in a way that is really unusual. So what we would do is we would help them with issues that they have away from work, so that when they do come to work, they're a lot happier and more productive. What we do is we encourage people to share their emotions, their feelings, the great things that are happening, maybe the not so great things that are happening. So what we do is we make sure that people are aware that we are here to listen and we are here to support. No matter what the issue is, they can talk to us about it. Sometimes we can resolve it, sometimes we can't, but at least we can try our best to help our colleagues.
Just thinking at the moment about sort of the cost of living crisis, and lots of people are talking about it, and lots of employers are worried about it, actually, that, you know, people are really struggling with their bills. And I was wondering sort of how do you do anything around that sort of part of their lives, your employees?
Every Thursday night when they do their cashing up, as we would call it, there is a button on there and it says, "How are you feeling today?" Okay, that's and nice. Our colleagues will put, will score a 10 and say, "Feeling absolutely brilliant." Or a colleague might say, put a 1 and say, "I'm feeling really poor. I just don't feel great." Okay, and from that, our area managers will contact those colleagues straight away and say, "Can I help? You know, is there anything I can do to help you? What's the issue?" We have a hardship fund. And at the moment, any given time, we've probably got about £400,000 out there in loans to our colleagues.
Right. Okay. That's quite a lot of money, isn't it?
It is. So if they're struggling financially, they can come to us and say, "Look, I need a new car, or my washing machine's broken down, or I've got a crisis at home with the children." And when we're not giving out loans, we'll also gift colleagues things, such as I saw a colleague only yesterday who is not managing his credit card. He's looking after his family, he's supporting his parents, he's doing everything he can, but he's got a credit card bill that he just can't keep on top of. So we've agreed to pay that directly for him. So it means when he does come to work, or she comes to work, that she can focus on work and actually enjoy it. We want people to be really happy at work, because a happy colleague is a really productive one, which means we're in a win-win situation. The more we invest in our people, the more money we make. It's very, very simple. I think there's still an element in businesses where they think kindness means being soft. And it's not the case. Kindness is a strength. And that's an integral part of our culture, is kindness and trust. And so we might have, 3 to 5% of our colleagues might not be kind people. They might take the mickey. But what we choose to do is focus on the 95%. And we're prepared to lose that little bit with the 3 to 5%, as long as we can focus on the other 95%. And I think some businesses can't see that. They think, why would you do that?
And what do you think the future is for well-being? I mean, what other things are you working on or initiatives at Timpson at the moment?
Well, in terms of well-being, we're always looking for new benefits. The more recent ones were an extra day off when your child starts primary school or nursery school for the first time, because we found that some of our colleagues were getting really distressed. You know, you can imagine, you drop them off at nursery or school and you're like, well, they're either crying or they're not bothered about you. So it's, you can't win, can you?
Or you're crying,
that's what I mean. And then you're hanging about thinking, oh, is he all right? Is she all right? And that worked really, really well. So then we decided, well, hold on a minute. It's not just a parent. We decided that grandparents should get an opportunity too. So what we have is an extra day off for any grandparent who has a grandchild. You know, again, because sometimes you will, and it might be a week after the baby's born before you can see your grandchild, but that doesn't matter. The latest one is pet bereavement day. So that's not when your goldfish dies, Chris. That is when your family pet, whether that's a cat, a dog, whatever it is, a hamster, it could be anything, as long as if it's your family pet and it's been with you. And the idea is to get the family together, get your head together, take that day to recover from it, and then, you know, come back to you. We have dreams come true where people can apply and say, my dream is to go to Las Vegas and take my great-grandmother who's never been able to go or whatever. And, and if they're successful. You've got to remember, though, that we only recruit superstars and we only want superstars. So in a way, we've got the best of the best. So why wouldn't we invest in the best of the best? Don't get me wrong, we work hard. We work really hard. Our expectations are really, really high, probably higher than most. But because we have so much fun along the way and we want to work hard and work as a family to achieve the same goal, it makes life so much easier. It's just like being at home with your family. You work together to make things happen.
I note that your chairman, Sir John Timpson, actually wrote a book, A Guide to Mental Health at Work. And I think this is quite a... I think he details very much his own issues with mental health, which I think he suffered in the 70s and 80s, and I think occasionally even today. Mm-hmm. And it's quite rare for such a sort of leading business figure to be quite so open about their own battles with, for example, depression.
That's right. But we all know how real it is. And what it means is the rest of our colleagues can see such a senior figure and think, actually, if John is prepared to talk about it, then I'm not so afraid. And that makes a massive difference to our colleagues.
If you're frustrated that not enough of your people take advantage of the well-being resources you've put in place for them, then look no further than Buddy Boost. Our unique buddy system and community features are the magic ingredients which get people to team up and form healthy habits together. And they have a lot of fun along the way too. Download case studies from our website or email us on info@buddyboost.co.uk.
Sam Blevins is the Clinical Health and Wellbeing Development Manager for retail giant the John Lewis Partnership. I get a sense that a lot of wellbeing initiatives are much easier to deliver for office-based knowledge workers rather than workers on the front line in sectors such as retail. And therefore, how important was the role of the line manager in communicating these initiatives? Is it fair to say that for workers who are, for example, working in retail or transport, they probably have less access to wellbeing initiatives because of the work they do?
In a lot of areas, yes, because they're not having access to intranet. So often businesses will put all their health and wellbeing information on their intranet. If you're working in the retail space and you're coming in, you tend to come in, do your job, and then off you go with no time to look at that.
Yeah.
So often we just need to be a little bit more creative, and I would say agitate when we're out there talking to people about what would work for them.
And do you think, therefore, then, if you're in a retail environment, that that role of that branch manager or line management is really important in being able to communicate in wellbeing initiatives?
Yep. So for me, people managers, people that look after people, really do need to get it. They need to understand that health and well-being is not something that we just add on. We need to be living it, we need to be breathing it, and we need our managers, our leadership teams to be on board with that. But they need support. You need to make sure that this is a top-down, bottom-up approach. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. Mm. And we involve a lot of our senior leaders in a lot of what we do.
Dr. Alex Young is a former trauma and orthopaedic surgeon and the founder of Verti, a cutting-edge technology learning business that uses tech like augmented reality, about the explosion in the amount of well-being apps and tech on the market.
There's been a real explosion, I think, in example for well-being apps. Isn't there a temptation for organisations just to buy something off the shelf and hope that it works without really understanding what they've bought and whether it actually works or not?
I think if you look at meditation or mindfulness apps or anything like that that tries to combat stress on the app store, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions now. Yes. Knowing
I've got them all.
Yeah, knowing where to start is just absolutely crazy. But everyone is different, and no off-the-shelf solution is going to cater to every single individual or every single workplace. There's lots of people who are at sort of different stages of their own self-care and their own stress levels. So someone might actually need one-to-one direct therapy delivered through a certified practitioner. Someone might need time off. Someone might need a little bit of sort of perspective on what's happening and some coaching from their manager or their team.
I asked Dr. Alex for his take on the importance of the relationship between line manager and employee in sustaining a positive working environment.
And what I think really comes across with what you're saying is actually it's the relationship, isn't it, between worker or employee and their line manager, which is kind of essential in all of this, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, we've seen that intensify more so during the pandemic period, where people's stresses are no longer just related to work when they're discussing things with their line managers or their HR leads. Leaders at every level of an organization now need to take even more interest in people's home lives, to ask them how they're doing, to start meetings a little bit more thoughtfully than they might have done pre-pandemic. I always tell our team to make sure that they start meetings by just building rapport, asking people how they're doing, having very sort of open, transparent one-to-one conversations around that. Because, now for anyone working from home remotely, your home life is your work life. So if you can't get any peace and quiet, if you are stressed out about something, that is, much more of a work problem even than it was before. So I think you're absolutely right. That personalized one-to-one relationship is absolutely critical. And I'd say it sort of extends, beyond managers as well. If you are working with someone who's a colleague, if you are having an honest conversation with them, you've got to know how to recognize if they are struggling with something and where to direct them for them to get the help they need.
Author and former ad agency boss Nigel Marsh, whose TED talk on work-life balance remains one of the platform's most popular with some 6 million views, responds to my question about whether the change in the relationship many of us had with work during the pandemic would be sustained.
Do you think, though, that in the way that the pandemic has helped us to sort of design our life a little bit better, that actually we've kind of got over this sort of fetishization of being busy, that we have to be busy, and we did have more time for nature, and we did have more time to walk the dog, and actually we enjoyed life a little bit more? Or do you think that now we're all just going to go back to the whole sort of, the hamster wheel of it all again, and nothing has changed, as you allude to?
Yeah, 100% the latter. But I think that when I give conference speeches about this, one of the things I say, and I can't remember if I said it in the TED speech, but is doing genuine reflection, which is what you need to do if you're going to sort out your life in any area, whether it's drug addiction or work-life balance or being fit or whatever. There has been a silver lining to COVID, which is it has encouraged reflection. Mm-hmm. So in the past, it used to be, divorce or death or something, but now you go, well, bloody hell, I'm sitting at home. Working for 2 years. But and the second thing it's done, which is encouraging, is helpful. It's its legitimized action. So if you are a woman and you say, I'm pregnant, I'm going to have a baby, so I'm not going to be in the office for the next month or so, that's a good excuse. You know, I mean, a legitimate reason. So people, they don't say, oh, that's outrageous. They go, good. If you were a man and you just say, oh, I just think my life's out of balance, so I'd like to do one day at home, that they think you've got rocks in your head. But then the pandemic comes along and lots of people have been doing that and the world hasn't stopped spinning. But if you haven't done the work yourself and made the decision yourself, then it makes no difference. No difference at all. There are people who are going to be miserable workaholics with empty lives post-COVID, just as there were pre-COVID.
I then asked Nigel what he believes are the real organisational motivations for their wellbeing programmes.
So is the sort of the well-being agenda then that actually companies are, you know, really sort of getting pretty involved in their employees' lives now and making sure that, you know, they are healthy and that, you know, that they've got mental fitness and they're resilient and all the rest of it. How do you square that then? I mean, because if that's their agenda and actually you're saying, well, nothing has really changed, why would they be doing that, do you think?
I got hired to talk in Las Vegas where I had this briefing and they go, Nigel, we need to be seen to be doing something about work-life balance. So, you know, you've seen your TED talk, come over and talk to all, you know, global sales conference, lots of people there. But the guy said, but we don't want anyone to work less hard. I go, well, what the hell are you hiring me? You just want me to come over. And anyway, there's lots of companies, and I mean lots, where it's all a trick. It is all a trick. What they'll do is they'll say that they care, but then they'll set you objectives that are impossible to meet unless you are a workaholic. So they hired me because they go, well, we've got all these policies in place. You can take all this time off. You can do all this stuff, and people don't do it.
Why? Are they frightened to do it?
Yes. They go, if I work slightly less hard and you work harder, then you'll get on the A stream, I'll be on the B stream, or I might lose my job or whatever else. So people are rightly cynical. They don't know whether their company means it or not. So it's all that, wow. So if I could come on to the question that you asked about what is the role of the employer in this, is I think there are three very, very clear roles and companies overstep the mark and they should stop. So they should, you know, be good at whatever they're doing and do it well and profitably, or they go out of business. And then in terms of well-being, there's three things. They need to enable, they need to model, and they need to nudge. So enable is what Procter & Gamble in Latin America do, is they've got all these wonderful policies. So if you make the decision to be a balanced human being with a rewarding life that isn't just mono career, you are able to do it because they have enabled you. They don't force you to do it. They don't say you must not come in on Friday. They had a wonderful thing where they banned meetings on Friday afternoon. You go, well, that's rubbish. Some people want to do them. But if you don't want to do a meeting on Friday, that's fine. So be a company where you are reasonable and you enable. If someone says, oh, gosh, I want to take paternity leave or maternity leave, or I want to do part-time. So you enable people to do it. The second thing is you model. You have people at the top of your company who model the right behavior so that your employees realize that you aren't lying. So I don't know if you know Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, and lovely bloke. I heard that he starts work at 3:45. I think, bloody hell, that's pretty impressive. I mean, the day's almost over, you know, and he's a billionaire. And you go, no, 3:45 in the morning. You go, oh, that's 3:45 a.m. So it wouldn't really matter what you say, what policies you have to anybody. And the third thing is you've got to nudge. Okay, so there's this thing. I mean, I've set up a nude swim in Australia, an ocean swim, and it's obviously it's a nudge to make people happier. You know, it's not going to solve their body insecurities, but it might help. If they do that and the world doesn't collapse, they might think, gosh, maybe I should stop worrying so much. I did a thing called Earth Hour where you turn the lights out for an hour, and it's not going to save the planet, but it might make you more environmentally aware if you do, like taking action.
Charlotte Lockhart is co-founder and managing director for the 4-Day Week Global Campaign. Here, she explains how the 4-Day Week works.
We have a model which we call the 180-100 principle, where you are paid for 100% of your income, you work 80% of your time, and you provide 100% of your productivity. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're working a standard 37, 40-hour week or whether you're working 60 hours or whether you're working, you know, 20 hours. The idea is to reduce the amount of worker time but focus in on productivity and maintaining pay. Because let's face it, if productivity has remained the same, why should pay be reduced? But when you say to your people, you know what, guys, I want you to have to work, spend less time at work. So to do that, we need to find ways to make the workplace more productive. Well, I also don't want to reduce your pay. Then people will be motivated to find all the little nuances within their job as an individual, within their teams and within the organization as a whole. They'll find ways to help you increase productivity because they all want to go home and spend time with their children or have time for yoga or have time to educate themselves or, I don't know, just to binge watch Netflix. For most people, the motivation of what they would be able to do with time actually is the benefit that gets them thinking about it because they don't feel that their job is in any threat. And they also, sort of most importantly, don't feel like there is, you know, that anyone else in their team's job is under threat because they can all work together in terms of how they increase productivity. And the great thing about this, of course, is it's a huge team building exercise as people within an organization, no matter how large it is, work through what are the little nuances for our organization. And all that the C-suite has to do is set the boundaries around what is the measure that we need to get to. Is it a profitability measure? What are we measuring? What do you want us to get to? And different businesses have different things. And we've got more and more businesses that actually include well-being in the measurement. As part of what you're doing, we want this well-being outcome. So, you know, so that's kind of what we see. And if you think about it, you know, if you're at work, and you're clear about why you're there, you're clear about what's expected of you, and you are given the resources to do it, then you actually feel really good about it. You get to the end of the day going, I really feel like I contributed. And as humans, we like to feel like we matter. We like to feel like we contributed. So that also adds in to how people feel at work.
I asked Charlotte if the four-day week works better in office-based roles, such as lawyers, for example, and how best organisations should approach structuring the work.
Okay. I was just wondering, though, that does that work? Does it work better, for example, if you're working for a bank or a firm of architects or a law firm, or doesn't really matter?
Well, the interesting thing about law firms, of course, is they've got the whole, well, that'll never work in law because of the billable hour, right? Yeah, like you as a client want to pay for time. No, you want to pay for an output.
Yes.
And so actually the law firms that are doing this, and there is a real movement in law to this anyway, they are doing value-based billing now. Work with your people to find a way. So your bus driver example, you work with all of your bus drivers and you go, right, this is the service that we need to provide. How are we going to do it in less time? And then the other thing to question, of course, is this the service that we should be providing? And so the great thing about an organization going through this is they truly question what they're doing and how they execute it. And you can take it as deeply as you want, if you, you know, want. And some of it might be engaging with customers.
So that is the secret ingredient, isn't it? Is actually you have to ask your workforce, your employees, about how they would like to structure their day, essentially.
Yeah, because, you know, because the thing about it, of course, is that for most of these people, there's what they do know that could run better and what they don't know, but until they start practicing it. But when you empower them to find the ways to do it better, then they find all sorts of things because they're not worried about losing their jobs or their team member losing a job. Mm-hmm. So you take away all of that fear and all of that pressure because in the end, people just want meaningful work that they can come to, feel like they've achieved something, get paid properly, and then go home to all of the reasons why they earn that money in the first place.
Lastly, I catch up with Professor Sir Kerry Cooper CBE, the 50th anniversary professor of psychology at Manchester Business School, the University of Manchester. He is widely considered as the world's top thinker when it comes to employee well-being. I start by asking Professor Cooper if it's possible for a company to care about shareholder returns and employee well-being equally.
And just looking at sort of the focus that organisations have now on well-being and sort of the evangelism surrounding it and employee assistance programmes and all of those things, is it just really being boiled down to the retention and attraction of talent and overall business performance, or is it something else? I mean, if an organisation says, look, we really care about our employees, what do they actually mean? And do they care more about me as an employee, or do they really care more about the shareholder return? Or can you care about both?
Well, yeah, I think you can care about both. I think you can care about the bottom line. Look at, if it's not delivering to the bottom line, we got a problem there too, don't we?
Yeah,
we have
sure.
enough productivity issues. We have problems because of Brexit. We have problems because of the cost of living crisis and the cost of energy. Hey, we need to do both. There'll be people who are passionate in HR and occupational health about the health and well-being of people, even if it doesn't hit the bottom line, right? Exactly. But incidentally, the research evidence is it tends to hit the bottom line. So when Steve Bevan and I did our book, we tried to show that. And there's more and more research which is showing it will enhance our productivity, our performance, less sickness absence, less presenteeism, all of that kind of stuff. So we've known about that for a long time, but hardline productivity, we need more and more evidence on. But there'll be people who feel that this is good because it hits the bottom line. And particularly, by the way, the big one is talent management.
Yeah.
And talent retention.
Lastly, Professor Cooper neatly sums up what well-being is really all about.
This is it, because this is what a positive workplace culture and a real focus on well-being is. Not just about a juice bar or, you know, casual clothing, is it? It actually is how much control, discretion and autonomy an individual has over their work, isn't it?
Absolutely. Listen, this is not about beanbags. This is not about ping pong tables, sushi at your desk, or the well-being day where you get smoothies and your massages. It's not about that. By the way, it may have started that way in some organizations and in some sectors, right? And, you know, mindfulness at lunch and things like that. But it's morphed over the last 7 years into something more substantial. Mm-hmm. Now organizations, many of them in the public sector and the private sector, have a director of health and well-being reporting to either the HR director, chief medical officer, or in some cases, the CEO. Mm. So that, I think, is really important. If you look at the NHS, by the way, do you know that every single board of an acute or any trust has now a non-executive director who's responsible for health and well-being?
There you have it. Essentially, employee well-being is now considered a business critical factor. We've learned that well-being isn't about juice bars and beanbags, but it's a fundamental approach that looks at job design, the quality of line managers, organizational culture, employee autonomy, and of course, commitment from the very top of the organization. My thanks to all of my guests and contributors for season one of that Wellbeing at Work show. And you can, of course, listen to all of the episodes in full by visiting buddyboost.co.uk/podcasts. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to that Wellbeing at Work show. To listen to more episodes and to find out more on how Buddy Boost can drive engagement in your wellbeing programmes, go to our website or email us on info@buddyboost.co.uk.